Welcome to McFly's Movie House, a weekly podcast that delves into cinema's hidden gems, celebrating forgotten classics and emerging filmmakers while fostering an inclusive film narrative. I'm your host, Marta Georgievich, and I'm excited to have you over. Hello, and welcome back to McFly's Movie House. I'm your host, Marta McFly, and today we're doing something a pinch different from last time. As I'm sure everybody knows by now, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, the second part, has already come out by the time this episode releases, so I figured this is a perfect time to discuss David Lynch's Dune from 1984, a commercial flop that the director has basically disowned himself. But the reason I want to chat about it is, look, it's not a masterpiece. I'm not here to tell you that, but I also think that it's a lot more despised than it should be. And as a huge Lynch fan myself, I feel like he gets flack for this one to this day for a movie with issues that weren't entirely his fault, not to mention that some good came out of it as well for his future projects. So all this to say, I think it's really interesting to chat about. And with me today to help out is a very good friend of mine. He also happens to be in the film content creation space. He's a wealth of knowledge when it comes to all things cinema, and he's also an aspiring filmmaker as well. But most importantly, he's a massive Dune fan. He has some killer copies of the book that's based off of by Frank Herbert. So without yapping on for hours, I'm welcoming Martin Padilla to the pod. Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good. How excited are you to chat about Dune?
I'm so excited. I think when it comes to Dune, everyone in my like space, you know, family, friends, they all just kind of know I'm a Dune fan. So for Christmas, birthdays, whatever it is, I always get some sort of Dune-related gift. So like this past Christmas, I got this like Dune board game, which I've yet to play, but it looks really cool.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I'm going to shut this out again at the end of the episode, but for right now, where can folks find you?
On most socials, I'm on AlejandroXPADI. On Instagram, I think it's LLA at the end of it, so my last name, PADILLA. But most socials, it's just PADI, just it's easier.
And it'll be in the description as well. But before we dive into David Lynch's Dune, I'm curious, what have you watched recently, and what do you recommend everybody else check out?
I've been watching Dune in preparation for this episode. So I did watch the 1984 Dune. I did watch the sci-fi series that they put out. And then I watched Denis Villeneuve's Dune last night. In terms of what I've been watching a lot right now just because, I mean, it's just, you know, early in the year, you always want to get catch up on all the Oscar bait films. So, I mean, Poor Things doesn't really feel like it's Oscar bait. It definitely feels like it belongs there. I know that you saw that, I believe.
Yeah, oh my god, it was like my movie of the year.
Yeah, I saw your review for it, and I just immediately was like, I gotta see this. But, I mean, I was really excited for that film in general. I'm a huge Yorgos Lanthimos fan. But just in general, I mean, just catching up on everything. I saw American Fiction the other day, I really like that. Overall, just trying to catch up on new things. I don't know if you could see this back here, but this Larry Clark Kids Blu-ray copy. Oh. I picked that up on Christmas, like the day after Christmas, at a record store in Austin, Texas, and, I've just been meaning to watch it since. It's just I picked it up because I knew I wouldn't find it anywhere else.
Oh, you've never seen it before?
I've not. I've just kind of recently started getting into Harmony Korine's films and, like, Larry Clark. And I see the Greg Araki shirt that you have on.
Yes.
So it's trying to get into their stuff as well, just kind of, like, leading into a little bit more of Larry Clark, Harmony Korine. I know that he's got Aggro Drift that everyone's been kind of polarized on recently. But I did see Gulo for the first time, which I actually watched upon your review. In your recommendation.
Cool. Nice.
But yeah,
just trying to get... I don't even remember reviewing that.
I don't know if you actually reviewed it, but I think you did mention it at one point. And then I saw your review for it on Letterboxd or like your rating for it. And I think I was like, if Martyr likes it, I'll trust it.
Yes. I love that. For starters, just to give like a brief overview of the plot for the folks who haven't seen it of Dune, I'm just going to read the Letterboxd description because it's quick. It says, in the year 10,191, the world is at war for control of the desert planet Dune, the only place where the time travel substance, spice, can be found. But when one leader gives up control, it's only so he can stage a coup with some unsavory characters. I mean, that's super vague, but that's basically it, right?
It is. It's strange to describe this film to people as a whole and just, I mean, the story. Because I have a friend who's trying to get into it, and he's like, what is this story even about? And I was just like, dude, it's just Game of Thrones in space. It's a lot better.
Yeah.
Or even better, like, Lawrence of Arabia in space is the one that I've heard the most. Like, people comparing it to that.
Yeah. Oh, man. That I never even thought of the comparison with Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. I mean, Game of Thrones, definitely. But Lawrence of Arabia, yeah, that's a good one.
How much research have you done on this 84 version of David Lynch?
Let me tell you, I've done so much. We'll get into it, but I've done a lot. I also have his two biographies as well, which are just such a wealth of information. So to give everyone, I guess, context of what was going on for Lynch at the time. So he started his directorial career with a bunch of short films. And then in 1977, he made his feature debut with Eraserhead. And then in 1980, he did The Elephant Man, which I remember watching in high school. Have you seen it? It's a brilliant film.
I've seen it. It was a very long time ago. I also saw it in high school. High school's kind of when I started to kind of really dive into a lot of more of like the obscure aspect of film, like maybe not something so commercial. David Lynch was always at the top of every list of like directors to watch. And so that was one that I remember watching. And then it was actually around the same time that Denis Villeneuve had announced that he was doing an adaptation of Dune. And I had a professor who told me that David Lynch did it, and I saw his name on there, and I was like, oh, well, if he did it, and his name is always at the top of these lists, it's gotta be good. But yeah, that was my first experience watching it.
After The Elephant Man, I think 4 years later, that's when Dune was released, and Lynch was a fan of the novel, and there were certain elements and, I guess, characters that attracted him to the story, especially that of our lead, Paul Atreides. And as I mentioned, I was reading Lynch on Lynch, one of those biographies, and producer Stuart Kornfeld, who brought the project of The Elephant Man to Lynch, he had his own theory on why Lynch decided to take on this daunting task, because it was daunting, especially for him, who only had two features under his belt. So Kornfeld said, quote, "I think David had spent enough years dealing with being a broke artist and living through the nightmare of this is never going to happen to me." And in another biography, Room to Dream, which actually describes Lynch's coming up in Hollywood really well, and I really recommend it. But basically, Lynch and Dino De Laurentiis, the producer behind Dune, he had him approach him with a blank check. And I mean, for production. So if you're a young director, if you're getting approached with a blank check, if you love the story, why wouldn't you do it, right? Like, it just makes sense, no?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think any writer would like that now. I believe, you know, it's a lot easier for a story like that to hear about, especially with, like, a time in the 70s, whereas streaming now, it seems like a lot of established directors, people who, you know, people know the names of Martin Scorsese, Kristen Stewart, I think, is trying to get a film funded right now, and they can't get anyone to fund them because just streaming is just terrified of really cutting a blank check for anybody, and then they cut a $55 million check for the guy that did Ronin 47, so...
So to rewind a pinch, in the past, before Lynch got his hands on Dune, he wasn't the first to tackle it. I feel like you know where I'm going with this. So in 1971, I don't know if you know this part, actually, the Planet of the Apes producer, Arthur P. Jacobs, he had a twinkle of an idea to make Dune into a movie. And shortly after acquiring the rights, he had a heart attack and he died. And then after that, Alejandro Jodorowsky tried making it into a 10-hour film as well. There's a great documentary I suggest people watch if they haven't seen it called Jodorowsky's Dune, which takes you through the entire journey of him trying to make it. It's bonkers. From what I recall, there was supposed to be a score by Pink Floyd. Salvador Dali was supposed to be in it, as was Mick Jagger. Like, it's just crazy. These sketches and the artwork of all the sets and the costumes, they're insane. And after spending $2 million in 2 years in pre-production, the whole thing just fell apart because it was just too ambitious and too expensive. Also, as an aside, I chuckle at the fact that Jodorowsky never even read Dune. Like, he was just going off of what other people told him. Like, isn't that crazy?
I rewatched it the other day as well in preparation for this, just to kind of like refresh my memory, because I had seen the documentary before, but it is kind of crazy that he's never read the book and that he just went off of what people have told him. Like, I still think about it. I still tell my friends about it. I'm like, dude, like, none of this sci-fi that you see now, it would be possible if, like, if he didn't get all these people together.
Right? And do you think, like, if he had a chance to make it, would it have been as successful as some people say it would have?
I don't think it would have been as successful amongst, you know, like, I don't think it'd be a very commercial film. That being said, though, there are people like us out there who go out of our way to watch something like The Holy Mountain or El Topo or Fanduilis. And they have a real cult sort of following to them. And in a way that sort of became, I think, David Lynch's Dune. Because, I mean, he even said that he saw it. He hated it. He thought it was terrible. But it's like, the reason it ended up that way is just so much interference from everybody else. Like, you're lucky you didn't get that interference.
Yeah. Exactly. And so after that failed attempt, I don't know if you know this, but Ridley Scott almost took control of developing it into a movie. Did you know that?
I had heard a few different things about him being involved, but it's also just one of those stories that, I mean, being a huge fan of it, even I'm like, I wish I could do Dune someday, but I can understand why Ridley Scott would want to do it. He's big into sci-fi. He pretty much jumpstarted all the Alien stuff in 77.
Totally.
I think it makes sense. It's one of those movies that's kind of like, you know, at some point you hear so many directors have had their name in the running for something big, and it makes sense for, I think, Ridley Scott to have been involved as well.
Totally. But so then I couldn't figure out why he didn't do it, but he didn't do it. He did Blade Runner instead. And so then Lynch came along after De Laurentiis reached out to him in 1981. And De Laurentiis loved Lynch. And his daughter actually claimed, I was reading this, that he thought that Lynch was as good as Fellini. And De Laurentiis actually worked with Fellini. He worked on La Strada. He worked on Knights of Cabiria. So huge praise, right? And at this point, Lynch was already doing, or no, he was approached about doing Return of the Jedi, but he didn't want to do it because he couldn't put his own like Lynchian stamp on it. But with Dune, he thought it was just this exciting opportunity. He loved the depth and the characterizations. He said that he saw Dune as a story of a quest of enlightenment. And so that was part of the attraction. And then with the textures and the visuals that sprung to his mind when he read the book, just this entire concept of world building is what excited him. Do you want to add anything to that?
I think it makes sense. I mean, like you're saying, like, you know, being compared to Fellini and then having him have worked with Fellini, it makes sense to like be so confident and be like, oh yeah, like we're gonna get something good out of David Lynch.
Exactly.
But yeah, absolutely. I think it's a story about enlightenment to many other things, but I mean, enlightenment and just being able to like add this sort of archetype of a messiah character that we know so well from so many movies like The Matrix, Star Wars even, of, you know, mm-hmm. like there's always this chosen one. And I think it really makes a lot of sense for a film like Dune and a series like Dune to start off like that.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And then there's also, I mean, to me, it makes sense that Lynch would take it on as well, because with Eraserhead, for example, it was very nightmarish. And then with The Elephant Man, we get dream sequences as well. So all those elements are a part of Dune too, like with Paul's dreams and his visions. And there's also, I mean, in my opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, a focus on machinery present in Dune too, which is also in Eraserhead. It's also in The Elephant Man. Are there any other similarities that I'm missing?
I think you've pretty much got all the similarities. I mean, you're bringing all this stuff up, and I could understand how somebody, especially like someone back then funding the movie, would be like, oh, well, he'd be the perfect candidate for that. Like, if he's already done all of these things just in different stories, why not let him take a shot at it?
With a blank check. Like, oh man, what an idea. But back to the production story. So things actually started off really like great. Lynch had talks with Frank Herbert, literally going through every line in the book, everything, on how to bring his world to life. He did, I believe, 7 drafts of the script. And he initially wanted to co-write Dune with Chris DeVore and Eric Berggren, who worked on The Elephant Man. And De Laurentiis didn't like that. And this is where he started getting involved, or so Lynch says, allegedly, I should add. So he decided to do it alone. De Laurentiis was his editor. And they finally narrowed down the script to 135 pages, and a lot needed to be cut. And this is where things begin being a problem, because De Laurentiis didn't want to make him or allow him to make a movie over 2 hours and 17 minutes long, because he wanted to make some money. So things like voiceovers were incorporated versus actual scenes. Lynch actually hated that. And he even said, this is just not the way to be doing things. But in the movie, there's an obscene amount of voiceovers. And according to Lynch, while some of those were supposed to be there, I'm pretty sure 40% were added later on to make things easier for people who didn't know the book. And in the theatrical run too, people were handed out cheat sheets with, yeah, like names of who everybody
like
is.
All the, that's also in the novel as well. So
really,
it's like, yeah, the copy that I have anyway, I've bought like 3 different copies of it. But I actually had an old copy of the 1984 like tie-in that came with the movie that has like the David Lynch artwork on it. That one had a cheat sheet on the back of it that had all the phrases like Muad'Dib, that had all of the like Shai Hulud, like every single thing was described like to a T. Same thing with that other version that I have that I sent you a picture of. It's a very, very nice copy I have, and the back of it has just like a glossary of terms.
I mean, I did that with Game of Thrones as well. When I watched Game of Thrones for the first time, I made myself a tree. And I probably should have done that with Dune as well, because when you watch it for the first time, like, I was confused. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you show anybody this film, it's also just helpful if they don't want to read the book. Just watch the Denis Villeneuve version. Get like a YouTube video that just explains everything, and it just makes so much more sense.
Yeah. Obviously, compressing the film so much time-wise, that was a huge issue for this version. And with those voiceovers, I mean, what did you think? Because sometimes they felt constant for me, and it honestly kind of took me out of the movie, personally.
I think with this specific film, and I think this is with any real film from, like, any movie that has studio interference, you can tell what the director intended a lot of times. So it's like, there's a few voiceovers that I'm like, okay, yeah, that's David. There's a few that I'm like, okay, they made him do this. Even with, I mean, back to Ridley Scott, for example, who actually went on to do Blade Runner, kind of had the same issue there where, like, the studio thought they could fix it by adding voiceover. They thought they could fix it by adding this. Whereas I watched all three versions, and I really, Blade Runner is one of my absolute favorites now as well, which is why I find this fascinating. But the first time I watched Blade Runner, I hated it. And it was because I watched it with the voiceover.
I see, I see. See, that didn't bother me that much in Blade Runner. I don't know why, although granted, I need to revisit it. But it really bugged me in David Lynch's Dune. But what else was he going to do? I mean, important scenes were cut out as well because of De Laurentiis, which is why the second half feels very, very rushed, in my opinion. And actually, when I was watching it this time around, it was after I've obviously seen Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 1, and I realized that David Lynch's Dune, for the most part, is fine up until the point where part one of Denis Villeneuve's stops, if that makes sense.
It does. Absolutely. Right? Yeah. I was rewatching it, and I'm rereading the book now as well, and I remember thinking the same thing. I want to say like the first hour and 20 minutes of part one, maybe hour and 30 minutes, and then after that, it's just, it rushes through so much of the second part, which is really the most integral part of the story, I believe.
Yeah, and he just like dumps it onto you in under an hour, I think. Yeah, you're right. If it's fine for an hour and 20 minutes, then yeah, you get the rest of the story in like 45 minutes, somewhere there.
It's just the ending is so rushed, and it's like the most important part, but it's also the world building aspect of like the first 30 to 40 minutes. I could see why he didn't want to cut any of that out, but then also so much of the end is just rushed that it feels like there's no real stakes.
Totally. Let's go back again. So the script was done, and Lynch was then in and out of Mexico for 6 months, I believe, during pre-production. Then he settled for the shoot to begin in March of 1983. And then production designer Anthony Masters, who did 2001 A Space Odyssey, he was on board, crazy, as was special effects artist Carlo Rambaldi, who did Alien, he did E.T. So Lynch just had this, like, everything was set up to be good, except for that script, right? So 2 weeks were devoted to rehearsal, and then filming began March 30th at Churubusco Studios, which I found out is the oldest movie studio in Mexico, or one of. And there's a great story from the production of Dune that details all their work in Mexico. It's by the New York Times, so definitely check that out if you haven't. But it explains that Mexico just seemed like the logical place to shoot in, because in Europe, there was no country with enough stage space and desert, while in Hollywood, having to rent that many stages would have cost so much more, right? So they were granted a budget of $40 million. 1,700 people were approximately in the cast and crew. 4 camera units worked simultaneously. 80 sets filled 8 sound stages. I mean, that's just unheard of, right? Mm-hmm. For this time, at least. and then the shots that were done outside, they had 300 crew members preparing all the sand dunes, and think this is being done in Mexican heat, right? I heard stories of people fainting. There were just so many issues, and De Laurentiis actually revealed that during the first month and a half, 15% of their crew was in the hospital for one reason or another. It's just crazy. But the biggest one was the injury that happened to Jürgen Prochnow. I'm butchering that name, but he's the one that played Duke Leto. Did you hear what happened to him?
I do. I you can tell you can tell us what happened, but yes, yeah.
So for those of you who don't know, the scene where Leto tries to assassinate the Baron with the tooth implant of poison gas, That's in the dream that Paul has. So in the dream, the Baron tears Leto's cheek, releasing the green gas. And this actually hurt the actor. There was a fake cheek that was attached to a tube for the special effect. And then an off-camera crew member would be pumping smoke that surfaced through the cheek. So they tested it on a dummy. They tested it on the actor himself. Yet when it came time to film the scene, the makeup used over the fake cheek wasn't sealed properly. So all that smoke and all that heat is getting built up under. And then when they went to rip the cheek open, he jumped up. He ran off camera holding his real smoking cheek, which is, again, just how does this happen? And he sustained second and first degree burns from this. I mean, how crazy.
I think hearing about that story is just one of those things where it's like you just hear about a cursed production, and every time you tell somebody about a scene in a movie, you're like, this actually happened during this. So it's like Lord of the Rings, him hitting the helmet and breaking his foot. It's like that's just the one that Dune fans know.
So with all these issues going on, it just wasn't turning out what Lynch wanted it to be, to say like the very least. The production costs were escalating during filming. This was 3.5 years. It exceeded its $40 million budget, which I adjusted it to inflation. Let me see. That would have been $99.5 million in 2015. So this just all also significantly reduced those initially great special effects, which means that some of them look fantastic, and then others just look like a dumpster fire, like those shields. Do you remember
the shields? Yeah, I was going to say the shields. I think everybody says the shields.
It's always the shields. I don't even know what else. But like, that's the thing. Some of those effects really don't look that bad.
They don't, especially for the time. I mean, it's no different than what you'd see in something like Star Wars, which is kind of crazy. But I mean, yeah, the shields, I think, in concept, I think they could have gone with a different route on how to make them look. I just think they were overthinking what they wanted to look like.
or it's just that, fuck, that money was a mess up for sure. And so throughout all of this, David Lynch's mental state may have been deteriorating. But from what I read, he never actually let that affect the others that he was working with. So Sting, for example, he said how impressed he was that Lynch went from making these two features that were smaller, they were in black and white, to Dune, and how calm he felt, or how calm he seemed about it. And he never got a sense that Lynch was overwhelmed, and he tried to remain upbeat, which honestly breaks my heart to hear. It almost kind of sounds like a captain remaining on a sinking ship, you know?
He always talks about it like it is, and it saddens me to hear the way that he talks about Dune, because I mean, obviously this isn't the film he wanted to make, but I feel the same way about like David Fincher's Alien 3, because that's a film that just from beginning to end just had studio interference. Any film that really has that, really. Richard Kelly's Southland Tales is another film that I kind of think about, and that film really does feel like a dumpster fire, but I love it for those reasons. It's, you can tell how much heart and how much passion went into it from the directing asset and the writing aspect, that I think is just hard to ignore when there's real passion in something, especially whenever you have somebody who just didn't get to make the movie that they wanted to. And I mean, like, have you seen any of the, like, the box sets that they have from Arrow Video?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's a great box set, but I have a friend who has it, and he let me borrow it just to watch all the special features, because I'm a huge nerd like that. And so much of the special features have everybody talking about Lynch and how passionate he was about the film and how much he loved it. And it's so strange because he's just not in any of them. He refuses to do the special feature stuff for it, as you know, I'm sure. But he just doesn't talk about Dune. And it's because he just sees it like some bastardized child of his.
But this is why I mentioned that biography, Room to Dream. Do you have that? I forgot to ask you. Yeah, you do. Or no?
I don't.
Oh, no.
I've heard about it. I definitely need to read it. I'm trying to get more into like some of the Lynch stuff as well. Like I've seen all of Twin Peaks. I've seen a lot of his like features, but like I know that he has just so much books out there for some reason. Like he's got another documentary coming out with like Lynch and him, like his version of like Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
That I really want to watch as well. But yeah, I don't own the book. I haven't read it either. I need to.
The reason why it's good is because you get each chapter of his life is told twice. So it's told once by those that are closest to him, and then it's repeated again by Lynch himself. So for that Dune segment, you actually hear what other people had to say, a ton of other people, and then you hear his own thoughts. And it's probably, like you were saying, one of the few instances where he's actually talking about it properly and giving you his side of the story. So, I mean, that's what I used for the research for today.
That's awesome. I need to check it out.
So he said that a year and a half into making Dune, that's when he realized what a horrific situation he was in. And he also claimed that he learned a lot about making movies and Hollywood itself from that experience. So it begs the question, like, would we have gotten things like Mulholland Drive if it wasn't for this disaster?
I don't think if this film existed that we'd have many of the films that we have from Lynch today. I mean, he talks so much about this film and why he is so adamant about getting final cut privileges. And I think he's one of the only directors working in Hollywood right now that, like, that is a very real thing for, like, his contract, I guess you could say, with any film he does. Like, he knows that he is going to get the final say on what's in his films.
Rewind again. So Principal Photography, that wrapped up on September 9th of the same year. And then Lynch spent an additional four months working with models and in special effects, still in Mexico. And then he finally left in February of 1984. It was just such a mess by the time the movie was finished that he said that he doesn't even remember finishing it because he was just blinded by fear and disappointment. And in more recent years, like you said, he doesn't talk about it much, but he did say that he felt that he sold out with Dune and that he had no idea what was happening when he worked on the script. So it is what it is. You're actually going to find this next point interesting. I discovered it the other day. So with the first cut of Dune, the rough cut, that was 5 hours long. And it was screened only once in Mexico. I wonder what that was like. Do you know about this?
I know about the 5-hour cut. I know that it was screened. I don't know anything else about, like, what people thought of it. Does. It's just one of those things where I think as fans, like, we covet something like that. Like, the idea of watching something, you know, in its entirety. You know, hearing stories about, like, Jodorowsky's version of Dune and as well as, like, Fondo Elise and El Topo, like, having riots in the streets. I think those are just stories that you hear about and you're like, man, like, I wish I could have been there. I wish I could have been a person to see that. But yeah, having seen a 5-hour cut of David Lynch's Dune, I would love to see it. But it's just one of those things where we can only dream.
Maybe someday. His intended cut, so the 5-hour one screened once, his intended one was almost 3 hours. And then the final result is obviously shorter than that. But in 2001, Dino De Laurentiis actually admitted in an interview with BBC, I think it was a documentary, that Dune was destroyed in the editing room. But his daughter, Rafaela, she claims that the 5-hour cut would not have been a better film and that it was very dense. I mean, I don't know. Do you think attacking on, what, 2 more hours would have made a difference, or over 2 more hours?
I think once you get to a point where a film is 5 hours, maybe split into 2 movies, you know? I mean, they did the right choice, I think, with Denis Villeneuve's Dune. But there are some movies, I think, that I see that they get a 2-part movie and I'm like, you don't need 2 parts. Just give us 1 3-hour movie. Or they're not dense enough. And so maybe tacking on those 2 hours, I'd say just split it into 2 movies the way that they did now. I don't know why they butchered it to the point where we're rushing through 40 minutes of movie when there's still clearly a whole half of a novel to cover.
Exactly. And that's actually an interesting point and a good segue, because before his death in 1986, Frank Herbert was actually largely impressed by Lynch's representation of his universe. And I wonder if he ever got a chance to see that longer one or if all he saw was what came out. But even after Lynch was just butchered by critics, the one sliver of positivity that he had was that Herbert liked it. That's interesting to think about. You'd think that he maybe wouldn't, because so many fans don't like it either.
I think a lot of fans, you know, they don't love David Lynch's Dune, but it's also one of those things where people will say, like, technically it does translate a lot of what you read on the screen. But knowing that Frank Herbert read it or watched it and he liked it, I think it speaks a lot to the way that we, you know, watch the film ourselves. Like, watching it myself the other day, I remember thinking, like, some of this stuff is so goofy, but it also is, like, a very valid representation of what you're reading to page. It's like M. Night Shyamalan's Last Airbender. Technically, what you see on screen is what you see in the first season. It may just not have been executed well.
Yeah, and I mean, some good came out of it as well because of Dune, as you were saying. He vowed that he would never give up the right of a final cut, and it's remained that way. And that's why he's so hesitant for doing big budget productions as well. There's actually a phenomenal quote from Lynch that stuck out to me. It's on YouTube. I don't remember where it's from or what interview it was, but he dubbed Dune a big failure. And then he said, That's the big lesson. Don't make a film if it can't be the film you want to make. It's a joke and a sick joke, and it'll kill you. In the end, Dino De Laurentiis never lost faith in Lynch, even after this came out, even after Dune. And he was the one that gave him a chance to work on Blue Velvet. And I think that's honestly maybe, yeah, he just felt bad by what Dune ended up being ultimately. And Lynch just went for it with Blue Velvet and did everything that he wanted to do, finally, which I think is beautiful.
I think he's a bit hard on himself because, I mean, it really has just become such a cult classic, I think, in a lot of specific spaces for some reason. Arrow Video, I mentioned that they put out kind of a good box set for it. And they're kind of known for putting out like a lot of great cult classic films that I would say have gained a lot of popularity over time. One of them being Southland Tales, Donnie Darko, both Richard Kelly films that I loved. But they were movies that didn't do well at the box office. Neither of them did. I mean, Donnie Darko was released right after 9/11, so who wants to see a movie about a jet plane falling on a kid's room? But Dune is also just one of those movies that over time, I think a lot of people keep coming back to it because there are great ideas. Unfortunately, you know, the production was just bombarded with all these unfortunate events. But it is an adaptation that David Lynch did, and, you know, it's still a David Lynch film through and through. It feels like one. It just doesn't feel like his version.
Yeah, and I honestly felt that, because obviously I rewatched it as well before this episode. I think I very unfairly rated it the first time around. Like you said, it is very much so a Lynch film, especially in that first half with the dialogue too, the beats. It really reminded me of Twin Peaks even to a degree, just the way that they're interacting, right?
Twin Peaks, just I think of every weirdness. Time I watch it. Like this strange atmosphere to it. It's it's almost like off-putting at times, but it's so Lynch, I think.
Totally. Some good came out of this as well. Like we were saying with Blue Velvet, we were also granted some great Lynch collaborations that would repeat in the years to come. I mean, Dune was basically Kyle MacLachlan's big break, as bad as it was. And then he would do Twin Peaks with Lynch, which is where I fell in love with him. He was also in Blue Velvet. Everett McGill also came back for Twin Peaks. And then we had actors that appeared in Lynch's previous movies that were in Dune and then continued to work with him after that. You had Jack Nance, most notably, who was in Eraserhead. Then he later came back for Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, Wild at Heart. The list goes on. Same with Freddie Jones. So all this to say, these people never lost faith in Lynch, and I think that's beautiful.
I mean, really, even though it's like I said before, you know, this isn't a bad version of Dune that I'd say worked out. I would just say that this isn't the version of Dune that David Lynch meant to make. Like, yeah, it's not the best film. But I think, you know, even them shooting all those scenes, this 5-hour cut, they were there for all of that. So they know that this isn't the version that Lynch intended to make. But even then, this film just has a stacked cast. Like, even if you compare it to Dune now, in this original version of Dune, there's a very big cast in both these versions. I mean, you have Patrick Stewart, Brad Dourif, which I forgot was in this.
Yeah.
Max von Sydow, who's Seventh Seal, you know, legendary actor.
I was geeking out over Max von Sydow because when I watched Dune for the first time, this was before I was such a big Bergman fan, and I was going through the cast just list before I started this rewatch recently, and I was like, wait a minute, Max von Sydow from Bergman movies, what's he doing here? And I totally missed that the first time around, but yeah, you're right, he's in there too. It's crazy. But above all, I think Lynch is an American filmmaker. Obviously, he focuses on stories that are in America, and even though those themes can be universal, he still injects elements that are so very American. And by that I mean, you have the Pacific Northwest and the beauty of that in Twin Peaks. You have the, you know, allure and horrors of Hollywood in Mulholland Drive. You also have that take on the American road trip or road trip movie that's Wild at Heart, right? So, and so on and so forth. So I think after Dune, Lynch returned to that, and thank God he did, because like we were saying, after Dune, Blue Velvet came out 2 years later, and then Twin Peaks. That changed the TV procedural game, in my opinion. Anything else that I'm missing?
I don't think so. I think Twin Peaks, though, as a whole, really changed the game in terms of like what TV could really be. Like, I mean, I've seen so many different videos about Twin Peaks. I'm such a huge Twin Peaks fan myself.
Same.
I actually have this like really big book, if I can show it to you.
Please. Oh my gosh, I think I have the exact same one. Is it the Twin Peaks? Yes, I'm staring at it right now.
Yeah, it's. I found it at like a used bookstore for like $3. It was like the clearance section. I was like, you know what, dude, this is mine now.
I bought that for full price. That came out before the Twin Peaks: The Return came out, and that was my reading material to prepare for that third season. Oh,
I didn't get that until after I watched the show in its entirety. So that was one of those things where I remember watching it, and then also getting into Lynch's like all of Twin Peaks. Really, it was so hard for me to figure out what to watch, especially with like, do you have Twin Peaks on disc?
Me, I have Fire Walk With Me, but not the entire show.
So I have the entire show on Blu-ray, and for every episode, there's like this thing that has like the log lady as like an intro. And I, for the first time watching it, I was like, what is this? I was like, what is this show? What is this? What is this log lady thing?
Yeah. Oh, that's wild. So would Twin Peaks be your favorite by him then?
I think Twin Peaks or Mulholland Drive is probably my favorite work of his. He's such an interesting filmmaker to watch. I think that it's really hard for me to pinpoint down one, but those are the two I constantly come back to. I mean, with Dune, there's so much to cover, especially with like the story as a whole. But with David Lynch's Dune, I mean, did you know David Lean almost did a version of it?
No.
I think before they did. I mean, it was, he turned it down pretty quickly, but I think they offered it to David Lean. And he did Lawrence of Arabia, so that was one of those things where it's like Dune constantly being described as Lawrence of Arabia in space. Like, why would he want to do Lawrence of Arabia in space?
So, I mean, I could talk to you about Lynch for hours, but I think this is all we have time for right now. But can you give us a refresher of where people can find you?
I'm on most platforms, Instagram, Twitter, I guess X now. I don't really call it Twitter or X.
Yeah, nobody does.
TikTok as well, but most platforms, Alejandro, X-P-A-D-I is my last name. Poddy. Letterboxd as well. I'm on there.
Amazing.
Relay. I think Relay. We can give a shout out to Lucio, the Lucio brothers.
Relay as yeah. Well, I'm so honored to have had you on here, and I hope you come back. I think you will come back, actually. So
yeah, hopefully whenever I'm back, we can talk about Dune Part 2. See if maybe Denis Villeneuve actually did better than Lynch, because as of now, we only see half a story.
That is true, but it was a very good story at that, so...
It is.
We will see. Well, I will talk to you soon. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye. Thank you so much.
A Capital G Media production. McFly's Movie House is produced by Ghazal El-Hayi and Carmen Fong. Our music is Chunky Monkey by Stryker Big Band. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you want to go above and beyond, please be sure to share on socials. I'm Marta Georgievich, and make sure to come over every Monday to McFly's Movie House for all things cinema, film, and creative. Until then, stay safe and stay curious.